y'all mind moving down to the front? Because of the AV equipment, we need to be down here and also so that we can hear each other. Great. Are you gonna want to use this? Do we need to use this for them? Oh, I see. Okay. Does this make us famous if we use this microphone? It does? Okay. This is just like church. Nobody will sit on the front row. Yeah. Is this a Baptist situation? It's that way in the Episcopal Church, too, I'm afraid. I want to welcome you all tonight and congratulate you. Since we scheduled what I would consider the nuts and bolts work session of the community in terms of trying to figure out what in the heck's going on over here, Rod Byard has scheduled a party for April the 5th, and it looks like just about everybody's accepted an invitation to the party on April the 5th, but congratulate yourselves as being the people who are willing to do the work. And with that introduction, here comes Dr. Lolly.
I want to join Martha and thank you for coming. And I feel very uncomfortable standing this far away from you, stuck up here like this. But they're recording it, and I think that's probably best to let them record it. You may wonder what these experiments are for. This is an attempt over here to develop a mechanism for getting people down front. We're going to put those things on a sort of a pulley so that people sitting way back are going to end up at the front of the church from here on. Now, isn't that going to be interesting? The new president will like that. He will enjoy that very much. What we're doing is air conditioning this thing. You probably don't even notice it. And I hope you don't. I hope it's that good of a design. You can see right up there the way they're going to do it. They're putting an extra set of vents in up above the windows, and I think they have four or five grills. They don't have them in over here yet, so you can see the effect. And I think that the design people have really done a good job if it works. And they have one fear. You know what their big fear is? That when they turn it on, with all that equipment they put in upstairs, they put in two huge air handlers up top here, out of sight. They are afraid that these chandeliers are going to shake. They think maybe they've got the air diffused so much that it won't shake the chandeliers. But I told them that we had that covered too. If those shake, we'll just have a trustee designated to hold every one of them in place every time we have chapel, and that won't be any problem. They got to have something worthwhile to do, so we'll just have them to hold those chandeliers in place. You see those horns sticking out up there? A very interesting thing happened. You may not know this, but we have put over $200,000 in this organ. Jim Good is a thief and a thug and a thing like that. He said it was torn up. He said it was absolutely fixing to blow up, catch fire, set the whole campus fire, probably explode. That's what he told me. Got my attention. We asked the Canon people and some other people, and we finally got it all put together. And those horns are the only thing that I can tell that are different. That's everything else. It looks the same to me. We had an interesting thing. You probably didn't see it when we didn't have the cloth up there. We just finished putting all that cloth up to cover up all of the spot. Clarence Pierce, my dear, dear friend on plant services staff, came in, and we were talking about putting up the cloth, and we told him we don't want any put up there over those trumpets because they're going to have to work on them and tune them and do things, so just don't put any cloth up there. He said, "You see, man, over those horns up there?" I said, "Yeah, over those horns." And those are not horns, those are trumpets. He says, "It looked like they came off of 18-wheelers to me," and Jim Good liked to faint it. He came with a gnat's whisker fainting right there on the ground. But this chapel renovation project is really something that I had dreamed of, and I'm as proud of it as anything we've done. It's the most expensive thing that I've ever seen done anywhere under any circumstances. You can't tell it happened. The organ, you can't tell anything happened to it, and this air conditioning is almost it's about $175,000, and all you can see are those little vents. They shouldn't have cost that much. And then we do have a lift out front. that you probably saw that makes our chapel for the first time handicapped accessible, wheelchair accessible. And we're really, really proud of that. Well, that's all I wanted to say. No, not really. What I wanted to say is on this sheet of paper, I wanted to thank Martha, and I wanted to thank you for coming and for taking the time for dialogue. And I do hope that if you have a question that you have not yet had the chance to ask, you can ask it right here. And if any of us knows an answer to it, we'll share it with you. But before that, let me quickly outline what I would call the Wake Forest Southeastern Seminary public's connection. This seminary has many publics. I suppose that the largest circle of the publics is international, and certainly there's a national circle, and then more specifically a southeastern regional circle, and even more tightly drawn a North Carolina circle. So let me speak of each of those circles very briefly. Within the Southern Baptist Convention, which is national and international, there are six seminaries. Southeastern and the other five together have 20% of the students enrolled in an accredited theological training program in the United States and Canada tonight. One out of five of all seminary students in this nation and Canada is in a Southern Baptist seminary. The original timing of the seminary as an important part of the Southern Baptist Convention is indicated by the fact that the convention was born in 1845 and the first seminary in 1859. Southern Seminary was born very soon after the convention, which indicates that Southern Baptists have been sensitive to the need to train the ministers. Now, we've had a feeling that you do that best in a freestanding, denominationally related seminary. While many other denominations went the route of attaching their divinity schools to universities like Duke, as a Duke Divinity School is one of the schools in that multifaceted several school universities, our system was different. We put six seminaries across the United States, all the way from California to North Carolina, from Kansas City and Louisville down to New Orleans and Fort Worth. It's a good system, but it has some flaws to it. We're experiencing one of the types of flaws built into that system, given the polity of the Southern Baptist Convention. The seminaries do their work for Southern Baptists through a series of documents known as program statements. The Southern Baptist Convention writes and approves a program statement which tells this seminary and the other five what they expect it to accomplish for the denomination. And on the basis of that program statement, ever so often the seminary is reviewed, and every year is funded through the cooperative program. We get 60%+ of our operating budget from that single funding source. In 1859, when Southern Seminary was formed, there was the sentiment that for seminaries different from any other entity in the Southern Baptist Convention, it would be appropriate, it would even be desirable, for the seminary constituents, the faculty, to sign confessional statements as a kind of norm for the integrity of their covenant with the people. Here again, I think in the beginning that was an affirmation of how important the Baptist people believed ministry training really was. Nobody objected to that because everybody knew they weren't talking creed, they were talking confessional. And in a confessional, persons say what they say because that's what they feel in their consciences. They may totally disagree on any of the details of the confessional, and thus are not bound authoritatively, legally or otherwise, to it as a creed. Southeastern Seminary is the only one of the six that ever was formed in the original Southern Baptist territory. In 1845, Georgia was the center of things. In that's where the Southern Baptist Convention began. Southern Seminary was founded in Greenville, South Carolina. So when you say Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, you have said the original Southern Baptist territory. Southeastern, many people had thought we ought to have a seminary in that region. long time. We didn't have it till 1950, 51, when this school was formed. Now, there are two ways that Southeastern, being in this region, could demonstrate how it is affected by regionalism. Now, in order for you to understand the differences in this region of our country to other regions at some critical points as far as Baptists are concerned, this region, in my lifetime, has never had a serious controversy over communion, whether it's open to all Christians or whether it's closed to the particular denomination or the particular congregation celebrating communion when it is enjoyed in a church. We have an open communion mentality in the Southeast. Another way that the Southeast region differs from many other regions is at the point of women. There are churches in this region that 100 years ago began to ordain women to their diaconate. It is incredible for many people who are now Baptists in many regions of the United States, as Baptists have first of all moved out of this crescent I described from Virginia to Texas, moved across the nation, and are now in all 50 states in some numerous lots, and they have a great number of concentrations, Baptists do, in the so-called frontier states. It is incredible for them to believe that Baptists in the East don't have any difficulty at the point of communion and women being ordained into their diaconates. Oh, there are some churches that have some problems with that, but not nearly so much as everywhere else. Southeastern, in many ways, reflects that regionalism. Now, let me be specific about North Carolina. I checked today, of our alumni, North Carolina, of course, has the largest number. We have 2,200 alumni living in the state of North Carolina. 2,200. I did not do all the research I should have done, but I could not tell you tonight for sure how many pastorates in North Carolina are held by Southeastern alumni. It's pretty close to half of them. Then you add to that the church staff positions that are throughout this state, and you've got an enormous and awesome, really awe-inspiring number of the churches that are directly affected by Southeastern graduates. You can't believe then, that being the case, that North Carolina ought not be concerned about how this seminary goes. Because as this seminary goes, unless something dramatically changes in the next several years, so will go the leadership of over half the churches in this state. In Virginia, there are 800 alumni, and in South Carolina, 700. So when you put it all together, in these three contiguous states, an enormous percentage of the churches are directly affected by the products of this school. Now let me tell you a minute about the trustees. They are a public. There are only 30 trustees. These trustees are generally elected for 10 years. And that's so important for you to remember. They really have to be reelected after 5. But it's very normal for a trustee to be elected to 2 5-year terms, everything else being the same. These 30 trustees are our policymakers. We know who is boss, and their boss. 10 of them, by our charter, must live within 300 miles of the campus at Wake Forest. So it's not necessarily true to say that 10 of them must be from North Carolina, because 300 miles covers a greater arc than just this state. I believe it's fair to say that 300 miles would be, in some cases, in South Maryland, in eastern Tennessee, and certainly in the northern and central parts of South Carolina. 10 of them must come from within that region. The other 20 come from qualifying state conventions across America. So at any point, we'll have about 22 or 3 states represented in the 30-member Board of Trustees. These trustees are elected through a process that begins with the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. That president is elected. The president has the constitutional authority to appoint, as a president, he appoints, without approval of the denomination, 2 members from each qualifying state convention to the Committee on Committees. In turn, those 2 members of the Committee on Committees nominate to the annual convention each June a 2-member from each state committee on boards. In turn, that committee on boards nominates each convention in June annually trustees to fill every vacancy representative of every state on every agency. They tend to nominate about 160 or 75 trustees each year. Typically, Southeastern will have 3 new trustees nominated each year and about 3 returning for a new 5-year term. So generally speaking, 1/5 of Southeastern's trustees are up for at least review and renomination every year. Last June in St. Louis, for the first time in this school's history, the majority of the trustees of this school really do embrace the politicized movement that you've heard so much about. The new majority consists of 16, about 16, maybe 17, of the present number of 30. And that new majority is the point at which, if you have questions as to what is going on and why it is going on, that new majority is at that point of that controversy. Let me say quickly about the faculty, the staff, and the students. They, too, are part of the publics. We have 2 categories of faculty, elected and appointed. The elected faculty, number 36 right now. That means we have 36 tenure tracks that have been approved and funded. And those tracks are elected in time through a very precise process that we have worked on over the years. And the trustees culminate that process by electing persons to those slots. Appointed faculty are different. We need a lot of specialized teaching done. We have found that in our region, thankfully, there are a lot of good people that can do that teaching. They're very eager to help us when we ask them. So we have been able to contract with men and women throughout this region to teach courses for us, maybe 1 course a semester or 2 or 3 courses a semester. And we have done that until now, this current year, academic year. If you took the individual non-duplicating appointed faculty, there would be over 50 of them. So we have more appointed people teaching than we do elected people teaching. They don't teach more hours, but we do have them as far as headcount goes. The process for electing these faculty persons and approving these appointed persons was totally changed by the trustees unilaterally last October. The process up until now had been a 5-entity-owned process. The process was owned by the trustees, the president, the dean, the faculty, the students. Every one of those entities had a part in the procedure. Each one had a sense of ownership. The trustee new majority unilaterally seized that process and decided to make it their own and reacted to it and acted as if it were their own. And I can talk to you at length about that and its impact on my decision if you choose to ask questions about it. The staff of our school is a pretty varied thing. It's a pretty mixed bag. We have 22 administrative officers. An administrative officer is a person responsible for the administration of a fairly large center, administrative center in our school. It means that that individual manages other persons, is responsible for a budget, the control of the budget, and certain administrative processes. We are committed to a participatory management style. 14 years I've given myself to trying to see that through. In a nutshell, that means that what we do in management is get the decision made at the closest point of reference to the people who have to carry that decision out, so that hopefully the folks who help to make the decision help to feel some ownership of it and have a better sense of morale in the implementation of it. It works. In a nutshell, if you want to say it, it's the way the Japanese make a motor car. And it is precisely the difference between the new emerging management systems and the old pyramid system that General Motors got in trouble with. I read The Tea Leaves some years ago and came forth with a very fine concept that was put in my mind by a wonderful woman. That concept was, my people, let Pharaoh go. He's the guy who built the pyramids, and they don't work much better in management, as far as I'm concerned, than they did in burial places. They can't even find the bodies in them. But anyway, students, a lot of things about students. We've got Baptists, and we've got non-Baptists. I'm glad of that. This school has been committed to the non-Baptist student for a long time. They pay twice what others do, but we're glad to have them. We are now almost at 20%, we're right around 20% females in our student body. One out of five is a woman. We have ethnics. The average age of our student body this spring is 27 years, 4 months. And that means they've been doing something for about 4 or 5 years since they graduated from college. Our students are getting older. Alumni, that's an important public. Goodness. Just one more minute. There are 6,600 of them in round figures, and they're everywhere. Every state and in many nations overseas, 6,600. These alumni, these graduates, constitute the network for two critical functions at this school: recruitment of new students and financial resource development. Not that they have the money to give themselves, but the best way to get introduced to somebody who can benefit this seminary financially is through an alumni connection. That's what worries me most about the new emerging board's mentality. This board of trustees sees being alumnus as a liability rather than an asset. And when they began to think in terms of a president, one absolute unalterable qualification, as far as I can tell, was that the person could not be an alumnus of this school. Oh, they didn't say that, but they sure did act it out. And that's the sadness about it. I live to see the day when being an alumnus is a good benefit when you come to look for leadership at this school. And it's going to self-destruct unless that comes to pass, because a president has got to depend on the graduates, the products, to get at these matters of recruitment and financial development. I don't know the outcome when these are contrary to each other. Finally, the Wake Forest townspeople. You thought I'd get to that. When I got here in 1974, I think if you had asked me, I could have drawn for you some of the contours of the town-gown connection. It's almost there every town where there's a school. It's almost always more pronounced in a small town where there's a school. I felt it. You felt it. I know what it means. You know what it means. It was okay. It was more neutral than negative. But I wanted it to become a positive relationship. I wanted there to be bridges between this school that was here for keeps and this town that was here for keeps, both of which were begun in 1834 together. And I honestly set forth some attempts directly, personally, professionally, to see that happen. We haven't accomplished half what I had wanted to accomplish, but we've tried and in some cases achieved some good neighborliness. And I think that it will be to your everlasting credit in this town that your sense of outrage and your sense of saying it and showing it probably as much as anything else had a lot to do with a more moderate outcome in the presidential search than I believe many of the Board of Trustees would have personally preferred. I cannot prove this, and I'm certainly not charging it, but I'm convinced that some of the trustees would have much preferred either one of the other two finalists than the one that finally ended up as the nominee. But because, as I was told by someone who was in position to know, they increasingly realized that to plunge a radical person as radical as some of the people who were mentioned on the lists into this community, with all the implications of the town, the seminary, and the immediate surroundings, coupled with the alumni presence that is so close to this campus, would have been an absolute, unmitigated, unrecoverable tragedy. I agree with that. And I think it made a difference in their nomination. Thus ends my dialogue, you say monologue, on the publics. It's your time. What do you want to say? Or what are you thinking? If you have a question, ask, and I'll rephrase it so we can get it on the tape, and then we'll see if we can answer it. Go ahead, Martha. question, she's a sneaky person. She asked two questions going forward, one question coming back. So the total is three. What about the faculty? How do they feel about Dr. Drummond? And when's this all going to start? What's the date we've been reading all these things? Number one, I'm just finishing. Tomorrow I will complete a 175-hour engagement. It's the most powerful and beautiful, meaningful thing I slipped into doing. I didn't know how you close out a presidency. I don't have any, there aren't any books on it. So I said to myself, the one thing I can do from January to March is visit with every faculty and staff member. I started that in early January, and I'm finishing up. I have had the privilege of sitting in their offices with every one of them, and I haven't been rushed. I stayed as long as they wanted me to. I stayed in two and a half hours in some offices. On the average, about an hour and a half. It's been a beautiful experience. I found four things, and I'm writing them up in a little memo I'm sending them as a sort of a digest of what I've discovered. Solidarity. They are together, and they mean business. They are not wearing those ribbons for just fun. They represent a substantive thing. It's heritage, it's hope, and they're together. Second thing I found is the thing closest to the word that describes it is grief. Grief all the way from the first stage of denial to the last stage of acceptance, and the anger and the bargaining and the depression that fits in between those two extremes. That all of that is here. This community is grieving. The third thing I found is ambivalence, a sense of being pulled. Almost every one of them tell me there's part of them that wants to leave. In protest, in search of some further implementation of their calling, pursuit of some dream that's sick if not dead. And the other half of them wants to stay. Now, all I can tell you is that when I started 175 hours ago, two faculty were telling me they were going to take early retirement this year. One faculty member had just gone to visit another seminary and had an offer to come and be on that faculty. And I thought when I visited him a month ago, he was going. Two other faculty members had offers pending. I have now heard from four of those. The two who are going to take early retirement are not going to take early retirement. They're going to stay. The one who went for the visit and was offered a teaching post in another seminary has turned it down. He's going to stay. There are at least two others that are facing offers that I have not heard from yet. I do not know how they're doing. Of course, I can't speak for their feeling about Dr. Drummond. I don't think you really want me to get into that. They can talk about that themselves. I don't know how they feel about it. The date is now set. I had the chance of meeting this morning with Dr. Drummond and Mr. Crowley and Mr. DeLoach. They came to my office, and Lou and I visited with them. And the one irreducible bottom line that I told them we had to determine was what were their recommendations going to be on the 14th of March. When the election of the new president is set at 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon, 14 March, is when that election is scheduled. And knowing that no two or three can speak for the whole board, here is the decision. Mr. Crowley told me that he had personally contacted 23 of the board members, and that he had a majority of those 23, which I gather meant a majority of the board, which would take 16, who were committed to an April 1 day for the presidency to change. I will be president till March 31, the end of this month, and Mr. Drummond, if he's elected, will be president April 1. He has told them he cannot be here in April. He will not be able to be here. He told us today he had five revivals in April, which means that he will not be on the campus. And I will not be on the campus. So they have not told me exactly how they intend to run the school day by day. I don't know the answer to that. I'm assuming they will count on Paul Fletcher to
keep the processes and the systems going and the people in place administratively. But at this moment, knowing that it's not settled until it's settled, and the settled is when the full board vote, I'm preparing to depart the office on April 1. And I'm not going to fight about that. I'm not going to fuss about that, because I went on record in November 17 saying that when I would stay till July 31 or until my successor was chosen. And if my successor is chosen, I don't really have any ground to say when that person should be. Now, there were two other further elements in the negotiation today that should hold steady. I'm assuming they will. Number one, I will stay in the House until July 31, 88, or if we can vacate it earlier, we will. So we'll be living in 308 Durham Road until July 31. The second thing is, they invited me and I accepted it gladly to preside at both the graduations. We have a graduation in May, first weekend, and we have a graduation in July, and I intend to preside at both those. And that's basically the way we left it today. So I don't know how other than that to tell you, because it would be premature to say that's the way it is, but that's the way it looks like it is. Is that basically what you're asking, Martha? Okay. Yes, Beverly? I don't care either way, frankly. That's not being flippant. It's just telling it the way I really feel it right now. Beverly, it is true. Two things are true. The trustees are convinced, for right or wrong, some of them, and I would suspect that's the majority of them, that something about my presence is disruptive. Just the fact I'm here. I think they would feel that if I were asleep. It's just that way. Because I really have not done anything knowingly to confuse or to irritate or to agitate on this campus. I love this place too much. You don't tear up something you care for. But I nonetheless can understand they're thinking that. They're trustees who think that I'm responsible for everything that's happened since October. I mean, everything. You name it, I'm the bottom of it. And I can understand that. So it's so traumatized that I've come to the point where whatever is best to try to relieve the trauma from their side, I can't relieve it from their side, ultimately, I'm going to cooperate with. If I had my druthers, and I told the chairman last Wednesday in the Stouffer Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee, and wrote it down on a paper, a tablecloth. By the way, if you ever go to Nashville, stay at that Stouffer's. It's an interesting thing. Just opened it a month ago. And in their breakfast bar, it's not what it is. It's a breakfast restaurant. That's what it is, a breakfast restaurant. They have this place there, buffet place. They have paper claws on these tables, and they put a Crayola crayon box on there with you, and you can just doodle all over it. And I wrote down, my preference was to stay here and be president until the Monday following the spring graduation. That's May the 9th. And that I'd be glad to do that. Mr. Crowley said he called 23 people and they said no. And I'm going to listen to that. I don't have any fuss about that. I really don't. God's my witness. I don't have any sense of outrage about that. I think it's sad and I think it's unfortunate and I think it's kind of crazy not to have a president in the office. But I was told today that the office will be empty. I'll take my stuff and Mr. Drummond won't put his stuff in there till sometime in mid-May. So that's what it looks like. And if that makes sense to you, you got more sense than I got. That doesn't make sense to me, but that's the way it'll be. Okay, what else? Yes, Caniel? Caniel has asked, what about those rumors or whatever that got out earlier about there being a sort of en masse movement to another place to start another school? I don't see that as a possibility right now. In fact, I don't see it as a possibility in my foreseeable future. And I'll tell you why. Because it is such an awfully expensive operation. Someone has to have a fairly substantial financial commitment to do it. And that isn't there right now, not in a self-standing seminary sense. While three schools were studying the opening of a divinity school, three universities, Baptist connected, Mercer in it, Georgia, Wake Forest in North Carolina, and University of Richmond in Virginia, have study committees, and they're serious about it. They're studying whether to open divinity schools as a part of their university. My alma mater down in Birmingham, Alabama, Samford, received a $3.5 million grant, and they are announcing the opening of a divinity school starting this fall. So that's the first of the Baptist-connected universities that is doing something as an option or an alternative. They are intending to admit 40 students this fall, 40 additional ones next fall, and 40 additional ones the next fall. I heard indirectly from the son of the chief academic officer yesterday that they have over 100 people who are anticipating applying this fall. I don't know. But I predict that there will be at least one more, maybe more than one more, of those kind of endeavors. These will be connected with states instead of the national body. There may well emerge from all of this in time another self-standing sort of moderately oriented seminary, Keneal. It could, but at this moment, I think some things are going to have to happen in the denomination that have not yet happened. And I don't know all that I mean by that, but I just don't see it. Not within the next year or two. I do think that if it emerged, and if there were good solid backing for it and a good solid chance for it, that some of my colleagues here would have some sentiment to give that a try. But I'm speaking ahead of them. None of them have actually told me that. That's just a hunch. All right. Shirley has asked an awfully good question. She's asked my opinion on some things that would take a crystal ball to see clearly through, but I'm going to take a shot at what Shirley has asked. Is there any hope that things might be restored in the best sense of that? I don't think anybody feels that any seminary is perfect. I certainly don't think that about ours. It's about as close to it as any you could find, but it's not perfect. And there's some things that can be improved here and maybe will be improved through this trauma. I sure hope it's a teaching learning process. I do not know the rationale for employing or recommending a 62-year-old person. Mr. Drummond will be 62 when he assumes the presidency with a new year beginning, August 1. He'll be 62 by August 1. I think that's right. He's 61 now. Well, that, any way you slice it, that means that he is not going to be a president forever. 5 years would make him 67 or 8. 8 years would make him 70. And I don't know, he may be the world's most physical fit person, but if he's like most of us, he wouldn't want to take on a big old hard job every day like this, much beyond that, if that long. So I think the trustees have some sort of short-termness in mind. I don't know why I think that. And I think that they are at least projecting the possibility of not too long out there in the future a different president. I don't know what kind of mind they've got, but I'm thinking of a different president that might be more back toward the heritage of this school. Mr. Drummond may be right down the middle of the heritage of this school, but I know this, he doesn't know anything about it. He told me today he's only been on this campus one time. And he has had some association with a sister institution, and that speaks well of him. He has certainly had some association with a very high-profile Baptist evangelist, Billy Graham. And I've read the newspapers, as have you, and a lot's been made of his association with Dr. Graham. And that's commendable, but Billy Graham's not being elected president. You have to be your own person. I'm assuming he knows the points at which the pressure is going to come. The pressure is going to come really heavy. And I guess he's prepared for that. I certainly hope so. And it would be true with any president. It's not just him. Those are the dynamics that have been just left here. Nobody's created them. I'm going to San Antonio, and then I'm going to Las Vegas, and then to New Orleans, and then to Atlanta, and everywhere else Southern Baptists meet every June to beat fundamentalism in the Southern Baptist Convention. I just want to say it straight out. I'm going to beat them. I will live to see the day that this denomination is no longer hostage to the fundamentalist mindset. I know what I mean by that, and you do, and it's just that way. And I feel a little reactionary, but I'm just making a promise. I told Dr. Adrian Rogers that last Tuesday in a meeting he had with the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, that I don't intend to give my life away to the leadership of the people who've had it for 10 years now. They don't have a better denomination tonight than they had in 1979. They have a sick, divided, weak, laughed at, unfortunate caricature of the Southern Baptists that they got under control or began to get under control in 1979. They've diverted us from bold mission thrust, and they've tried to put a theological straitjacket around us to make us all lockstep in our beliefs and in our practices, and we're not going to do that. Now, it may take longer than I think it is for enough laypersons, and that's what it's going to take, enough laypersons who will pay the price of money and time and energy and discipline to get on airplanes and go to those national conventions and turn the thing around. It's certainly not impossible. Tragically, I talk to a lot of people around the country who say, oh, I'm so concerned. I'm so interested in something like this happening. And yet when you talk about, well, are you going to San Antonio in June, or is anyone from your church going to San Antonio in June, and they say no. Well, it doesn't make a hoot difference. As I told the people in Easley, South Carolina Sunday, what they feel if in the middle of June they are in Easley, South Carolina, and everybody else that's making a difference is San Antonio voting. You've got to be there. There are only two things that will make a difference, messengers and money. There will come a time when enough messengers show up to turn the fundamentalist away. I don't know what time that'll be. There is the hope and an outside possibility it could come as early as San Antonio. I don't know. But money makes a difference too. I told Mr. Rogers something that is very important to me. I don't know if it's important to him, and I don't know if it's important to anybody else, but it is verily the truth. When they have won the control of the Southern Baptist Convention nationally, they have won an empty victory. Because that entity, the national entity, does not generate one thin dime of funding. All the funding is generated on the local church level and is funneled through the state convention budgetary system to the national entity. And unless and until the fundamentalists control the state budgetary system in every constituent state of the Southern Baptist Convention, they won a great big balloon with no air in it. And what happened after St. Louis, Mr. Rogers said, is that the moderates came home and started organizing for San Antonio. He's dead wrong. What happened after St. Louis is that the fundamentalists didn't even come home. They went by way of certain strategy political meetings in the state conventions, and they had a master plan from Delaware, Maryland, all the way to Texas to gain control of the state conventions last fall. And they laid strategy and they politicized from St. Louis till November, June till November. And they lost every confrontational battle they had, every one of them. The states said no to fundamentalism. Now, it may take a while for that to filter up. It's awfully hard to transfer that to the national body because it's so much easier to control the national body than it is state body. But unless the fundamentalists behave better than they've been behaving on the national level, they're going to make the state people so mad that they're not going to keep on getting the money. And the day the cooperative program falls off 20%, and the day the Annie Armstrong and the Lottie Moon fall off 25%, that's the day the fundamentalists on the national level will start listening to people on the state level. Now, that sounds awfully crass, and in a Christian family, it ought not be like that, but it is. And I told Mr. Rogers, and he listened. I don't know if he agreed, but he listened. Yes, ma'am. None whatsoever. I've said to them, if they don't want to be called fundamentalists, they ought to stop behaving like fundamentalists. Just that simple. It's the only way I know to talk with them. There is a difference, Beth, and it's not theological as much as it is psychological. It's in the psyche, and psychological and spiritual and attitudinal. The fundamentalist mindset, and this is not going to sound very good, is identically the same wherever you find it. If you find it in Islam, it's like the Shiite Muslims. They're the fundamentalist of Islam. If you find it in the political arena, it's like fascism in Nazi Germany. They were the fundamentalists politically. And if you find it in the Southern Baptist Convention, it's like this bunch of people who are in control now and don't want anybody else to be in their picture unless we lockstep with them. That's the mentality. The difference in a nutshell between me and Bob Crowley is not so much theologically, though we do differ at that point. It is that if Bob Crowley had his way, he would bash my head in until I agreed with him. My opinion is he can believe it any way he wants to. He's a free churchman with a free conscience, and I'll work with him, but I want him to leave me free too. And that's the difference. And that's a big difference. And that's the fundamentalist difference, as I see it. Now, I may have it wrong, but there is the best two-page definition of fundamentalism that I've ever read. It's in a little book called A Theological Word Book. It's edited, and thus many, many people write the definitions. The article on fundamentalism is written by E.J. Carnell. E.J. Carnell died young, might have committed suicide. We don't know for sure about that. But he was a fundamentalist. And he began to distance himself a little bit from that attitude and spirit. And he was in such a bind in trying to withdraw from it and created such animosity among his former friends that he might have taken his life. We don't know, but he was a very brilliant person. In two pages in that little book, he has defined fundamentalism the best I've ever heard or read. And if you had the chance, you might talk to our librarians, Gene McLeod. You probably could see him, and if you could just visit with him sometime and ask him if he's got that book, he'd probably get it for. But it is a good book. I'm not kidding. Okay? It's 8:30. And I've just begun. You got me revved up. I'll talk all night if you don't watch out. Keneal? Question is, what can the townspeople do to support the faculty and staff who are going to be staying, and what can the townspeople do to help Mr. Drummond, if he's the elected president, to know that they want things kind of like they've been? I'm probably the world's worst person to try to answer that because I haven't thought that one through as much as I should have. I'm almost going to ask one or two of the people who are here that are going to be staying on the faculty or staff if they have a response to that. And while you're thinking, if one of you cares to make a response, I think the simplest thing is just tell them in any way that you can, any opportunity that you allow to see members of the faculty and see members of the staff as a townsperson, tell them what it means for them to stay by the stuff to you. And I think Mr. Drummond will hear. I think that he will have enough exposure early on to, you know, a new president is invited to speak to the Lions Club and the Rotary Club and the Kiwanis Club and the Civitan Club. He'll get those invitations the first month. And I hope those club members, if they feel it, when he comes to be their guest, will have subtle and maybe direct ways of saying, hey, we kind of like Southeastern the way it's been, and we kind of want you to hear us when we say that. And I would hope that townspeople, as they have the normal exchanges with him, will acquaint him with this little community. Now, he is not a mean man. I do not want to convey any negative things about him. His attitude and his spirit seem to be very commendable, as far as I know him. He can't be all bad because he married a girl from Dothan, Alabama. That shows pretty good sense. It's 40 miles from my hometown. The word got out he's from Alabama. He really isn't. He's from Illinois. And he married this young lady in Dothan, and he did attend the same college I attended. We found out today that we were there 1 year at the same time. That was the year of 1949. He graduated from my college in 50, and I arrived there in 1949. So we were freshmen and seniors on the same campus, and I honestly didn't remember him, and he didn't remember me, so I didn't know that. Now, I have met him off and on along the way, and he is a person that I believe that if enough people helped him to get a pulse of the community and tell him you want to help him to improve this school, any way he can improve it, Godspeed to him. But for him to suggest, as I understand some of the suggestions were made yesterday in the faculty meeting, that this school has had no sensitivity to evangelism and to missions and to certain of the things to which we've given our souls and our best effort, is of short-sightedness on his part. He needs to find out more than he apparently knows. At the point of evangelism, it is said that Southeastern should become a great center of evangelism. Well, there are a lot of ways to look at that, and I look at it as a pastoral educator, or if you want it backward, an educator pastor. As an educator, I see the task of the school as regards evangelism differently than as a pastor, I see the task of the church. Now, let me be specific. Evangelism, that is New Testament and holistic, is asking a person to respond to the claims of the gospel under the lordship of Jesus Christ by becoming a part of Jesus Christ's body, the church. Thus, evangelism has to be church-centered. It has to have something you join, something you're baptized into, some koinonia into which you plunge yourself and are discipled and grow up again. So evangelism is ultimately a task for the church. So what is the task of the school in evangelism? It is to enable the leaders of the church themselves to be evangelists and to equip the laypersons under their tutelage and guided by their model of servanthood in their evangelistic endeavors. Case in point, who is the better evangelist? The teacher who has 5 revivals a month, or the teacher who writes 7 books in 6 years, as the discipline to use in seminaries to train seminarians in the evangelistic task? I hope you don't ever have to be an either or, but for me in my house, if I had to pick, I'd pick the teacher who's written the books as being the more authentic evangelist from the school side than the one who has fire revivals. Now, that's just the way I see it. And I would think that you can get through to Mr. Drummond and help him to realize this school's been evangelistic. Delos Miles has written 7 books in 6 years, one of which, I don't know exactly how many, but about 30 seminaries are now using as a basic text in the principle of New Testament evangelism. That's evangelism, according to the academy. And I think that's pretty important. You saw I got up on my soapbox on that one. I will not stand on the ground and listen to somebody say this school's not been evangelistic. There was an interesting thing quoted yesterday, I understand, and that is that Cecil Ray, when he was executive director of this state, did a study. He, being from Texas and having some association with Southwestern, the school that is seen to be in the image business and the stereotype as the leading evangelistic school among our SIGs, he did some research. I don't know how scientific it was, and I don't know how he'd want to stand by it, but he used his best knowledge of the churches that were pastored by Southwestern graduates as compared to churches that were pastored by some Southeastern graduates in North Carolina. At the point of the numbers of new members and baptisms those churches had for a year. And he found, hands down, the Southeastern graduates outdid the Southwestern graduates. I don't know what that means. Probably doesn't mean a thing in the world. But it's certainly not fair to say this school is just going to begin its evangelistic efforts. Just like Tom Bland proved, the big lie to people who say you have to be in a great urban center to teach seminarians how to cope with urban problems. Folks used to kind of look at us and say, how in the world are you going to tell folks how to minister in Boston, New York, and Atlanta, and Cincinnati, and all the big cities living in Wake Forest, North Carolina? Well, we told them, and we've shown them. And Tom Bland has pioneered in urban seminars. And you don't have to be in the urban center every minute to learn the principles and the processes. Now, you have to have some hands-on urban experience, but that's what that's all about. He's helped them to do that. Can't answer that in a specific way because it could be a lot of variables. But I can tell you this, that if Southeastern's board were to retain the slots that are going to be reelected, and I think all 4 of the people are going to be renominated, and if they were reelected and moderates were elected in the 3 new spots rather than fundamentalists, it would turn around here in 1 year. Yeah, it's that thin a majority. It turned around in St. Louis, and it could turn around again in San Antonio. But now, if it doesn't turn in San Antonio, the chances are pretty good it won't turn in Las Vegas, because the same president will be responsible for the 2 years, then it's going to be a long time. But in this 1 year, it could turn in 1 year. Yeah, it could. That quickly. They could come to the campus next October and achieve all the turnarounds they did last October, because the moderates could be back in the majority. It's not gone yet. John? I wouldn't go unless I were a messenger. And that's the honest truth, John. It would be pleasant, I guess, to see it. But you can see it on BTN. We're going to have from gavel to gavel. Am I right, Ed? We're going to have the thing beamed back here. And in some room on this campus, you can see everything that goes on via television and save the hassle and the money and everything else. I'm going way out on a limb here. And I guess I'm talking to no more than just a half dozen churches probably represented. But there is proposed an airlift from North Carolina for the one day Tuesday, Super Tuesday. That day, a person can get to the convention by noon, vote on the president, vote on the committee on boards report, vote on the second part of the executive committee report, which can carries the PAC Baptist Joint Committee interface problem, vote on the first vice president, and come home and be home by midnight. If a person in a local Baptist church could see to it that 10 messengers from any church get on one of those airplanes, it's going to cost about, round figures, $300 a person, round trip, to go from North Carolina to San Antonio and back for that one significant day. If a church were being willing to put $3,000 in 10 messengers to go, it would make all the difference in the world. That's how somebody staying here could help somebody going. But you don't need to go without a messenger card because you can't vote. You couldn't participate in the debate. And chances are you couldn't even get in the hall because that is going to be a mess. Let me tell you what they told me. They told us last week in executive committee meeting, there are 6 rooms in the total convention complex. One room, the room where the main hall is, only 17,000 people can get in there. When you put that main hall in concert with the other 5 meeting rooms, and you put closed circuit television so they can see, and microphones like this around in the room so they can participate in the debate and so they can vote, they can make space available at the outside for 45,000 people. Only 17,000 of them are in the main hall. So you're going to have people in 6 or 7 or 8 places. They even have an overflow place, they told us, out in another part of San Antonio, away from this main hall, where people may have to be stationed to vote. If it gets past 45,000, we're in a real mess. And it's getting to be a real problem to have a convention like that, so I doubt people that don't have messenger cards can even get in the hall. Jackie? Jackie's question is, could there be a change in the order of business to vote before noon or earlier? The convention begins on Tuesday morning at 8:30. The answer to that is yes, because the messengers present at about 8:45 or 9 have to adopt the order of business from the Committee on Order of Business, who come forward with that little book that's printed. It can be done. But I can tell you now, it won't be done because they're going to be bussing them just as bad as we're going to be flying them. So it'll balance each other off. And we'll vote when it says you'll vote there. I'll guarantee you that. So you don't have to worry about that, I don't think. Yeah. The president and his appointee. You heard the truth. Yes, I expect it. And here's what's happened, John. Under the pressure of that many messengers for the last several years, there has evolved a black box. And that black box is attached to every microphone, and it is fed to a control panel operated at the main podium from which the president presides. And that black box is capable of emitting a signal so that when a mic is activated, that control panel tells which of the mics was activated first. You have to set a certain set of things on this black box at the mic, whether you're for the issue or against the issue, have a point of personal privilege, or whether you have a point of order. You push all those buttons, and it's fed up there. And they have total control, because if you got a mic in a room of 45,000 people or 17,000 people, and somebody turns it off suddenly, you're off the air. You don't participate. And that is exactly what has been happening. When you're in control of that kind of system, You control the debate. Now, they don't always control the ballot. You don't control the ballot that way. The ballot is on a ballot sheet pushed out by computers. So the ballots by ballot are pretty accurate. And I would imagine we'll have more of those, probably. And I do think that the debate is going to be controlled by whoever operates that mic. And I don't know how fair it'll be. I just can't speak to that. I don't know. But I do know last year, a lot of people that I talked to from my side of the issues had trouble getting access to a microphone. I guess it's just built into that bigger crowd. I've heard folks on the other side of the issue say the same thing. They couldn't get microphones either, so I don't know the answer to that. Why don't we, Martha, set a sort of a time to quit, because I don't want to go unduly. Let's take one or two more questions and then see if we can't conclude. A couple more. I believe we can conclude without a couple more. Let's pray. Do you all mind praying? Let's pray. Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. We have to believe in our hearts, O God, that this school belongs to thee, and that thy Holy Spirit has more invested here than we'll ever have, and that we had just as well try to protect Scripture as to try to protect this school. We know it is of thee, and we know that thy protecting and guarding and guiding are our only hope. So see us through, all of us, this passage, and we'll be grateful. For Jesus' sake, amen. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.